Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The spring equinox begins later today at 5:58 p.m. And it's special this year because there will also be a full moon tonight, a super moon, in fact, meaning that it'll be slightly larger than most of the other full moons this year. After the spring equinox, the northern hemisphere tilts toward the sun, which is why we start to get longer, sunnier days and why many people start their gardens and sow seeds this time of year. Joining us now with some spring gardening tips is Pete Murawski, an environmentalist and nurseryman and the owner of Native Landscapes and Garden Center in Pawling, New York. We would love to hear from you. You can give us a call with your winter gardening or your spring gardening questions now at 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Hello, Pete, and welcome back to our show.
Oh, thank you, Leonard. Great to be here.
And we should point out that we realize that we're broadcasting from the city, so there are all different kinds of gardeners out there. There are people only who are parts of community gardens. There are people who have backyards or have larger spaces, and some who just grow things in their apartments, right?
That's right, Leonard.
So all of those things are open for discussion.
That's right. There's a lot of different gardening going on there, whether it's a terrace garden, whether it's a beach garden, whether it's a mountain garden, whether it's a city garden in a park, vegetable gardens. There's so many things going on right now, and hey, spring is here, and now's the time to get started. And the further south you go, the quicker you can work the soil. The further north you go, like in the Hudson Valley where I'm located, there's still snow on the ground, so we have to wait a little bit longer before we can go out and do just about everything we have to do in the garden.
Isn't spring also considered the cleanup time?
It is, Leonard. And let's talk about that a little bit. Because
you mentioned the snow. There's snow in many parts of the metropolitan area still. Do we have to wait until it melts?
Not necessarily. You know, right now, when I say there's snow on the ground, there's still big patches and snow-plowed mounds of snow. But in the garden itself, it's pretty clear. And I was taking a walk around the garden yesterday, and I noticed some sticks that had fallen. You got to remember, too, we had a very windy winter. So a lot of branches and sticks have fallen into the garden. Leaves have blown all over the place. But when it comes to cleanup in the garden, yes, clean up some of the bulk stuff. But I think from an ecological landscape standpoint, we don't have to be super clean in our garden. We can leave some of the leaves. We can leave some of the small sticks, even on the lawn, because I see a lot of these guys out there with their blowers and they're just blowing all the organic off the lawns and the gardens. And that's not a healthy practice. You want to keep the organic. That's what builds the soil. It builds the organics in the soil and the microbes in the soil. And that's what we want. We want, in order to make our gardens healthier, there's got to be some microbes and mycorrhizal fungi and all this wonderful stuff that happens in the soil. And to do that, we got to keep some of the organics in the soil.
What about people who compost? Should they be putting the compost out on the soil right now?
Yes, they should. Now is the time to do that once the frost is out of the ground. And the best compost to use, Leonard, and I've always called it black gold, is the leaf mold. Okay, leaves, after a period of time, will decompose and make this wonderful black, peaty-looking stuff. Now, this is just alive with all kinds of mycorrhizal fungi, like I said before, and all kinds of microbes. And if you mix that into the soil, into the garden beds, you don't even have to fertilize. I think, you know, from a whole ecological landscaping standpoint, I think if we change some of our garden practices, not only will we keep a cleaner outdoor environment, but a more healthy outdoor environment. Okay, you know, getting away from a lot of these colored mulches that you see out there and go with a more organic approach. And it's not only healthier for us, it's healthier for our pets, and it's also healthier for wildlife.
How important is the nature of the soil? Because some soil is rather loamy, some is rather rocky.
Well, that's what this whole...
Or should we just be buying soil at garden centers?
No, I don't think that's necessary. And I think what we need to do, and what makes gardening and landscaping more successful, is run with the soil you have. Like you were saying before, we have all different kinds of soil. And let's use the Harlem Valley as an example. The Harlem Valley is an area that goes from the North Bronx right up to almost the Massachusetts line. And parts of the Harlem Valley have limestone soils. So if you try to take a rhododendron and put a rhododendron in a limestone soil, it's not going to work. Okay? Go use plants that are adapted to the soils you have. If you have thin soils, use plants that thrive in a thin soil area. Like and in a shady area, like ferns, for instance. If you have an area that has a little bit of protection from the wind and has nice peaty soil, then you can use rhododendrons there. I think it's important to look at the science behind what's going on in your backyard and bring in plants that are adapted to that particular environment.
And I assume you should also look at how long the sun hits a certain area. There are some areas that are shadier than others. Even if you have a house, one side tends to be shady, the other side tends to be sunny.
Well, Leonard, what you're talking about are microclimates. And properties can have 10 or 15 different microclimates on a property. The north side, and we were talking about snow before, the north side of a lot of houses up by us still have snow on the ground, where the south side is baking in heat, and all the bulbs are coming up already. You could have a house, and the north side of the house, which is facing the north, can be two climates warmer than the south side of the house, and that's why it's important to know the type of microclimates on your property, because as you know, Leonard, plants can be expensive, and you don't want to go out to a garden center and waste a ton of money on stuff and plants that won't survive on your property unless you know the science behind what's going on in your environment.
A reminder that our number here, if you want to speak to Pete Maruski on the air, is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. You mentioned bulbs. Now, people keep bulbs in dark spaces during the winter time. Is this a good time to be planting them?
Well,
or should they have already been planted?
They should have been planted in the fall, spring flowering bulbs. What people do sometimes is they force bulbs in their refrigerators or in a dark place and bring them out this time of year so that they got some daffodils or hyacinths blooming in and around Easter time, and it makes your house smell very nice. But you know, Leonard, every time we talk about this stuff, you know, it's always, I'm going to take it from a native plant concept. And when you say bulbs, there's daffodils, there's hyacinths, there's snowdrops, which aren't really native.
Now, tulips,
okay, which are fine. You know, they're not invasive. As long as they're not invasive and they're not taking over an area, I'm okay with that. But there are other stuff that are just as that are much more important to the natural world, like trout lilies and bloodroot and trillium. You know, this is stuff, if you're walking on the Appalachian Trail, which goes through the garden center, you're going to see popping up now, which many of the insects and animals are adapted to these type of flowers in the natural world. So if you want to do something that's a little bit more environmentally friendly and that you're going to feed wildlife, go with something that's a little bit more native, that's been here for 10,000 years, that might be feeding some type of wild insect or bug or animal.
So the birds are not interested in tulips?
Not many of the native birds. You'll see them working them. Some insects will work them, but for instance, some native flowers may attract, you know, 600 or 700 types of insects, where an exotic species from Europe or Asia might attract only 10 or 15 type of insects. I mean, I'm sold on this whole ecologically friendly landscaping, where we want to enhance the environment and feed the environment and keep native plants, animals, and insects alive and well.
What happened? Why are we in a situation now where local plants, which are perfectly fine, have in many cases been replaced by plants from Europe and Asia?
Well, Leonard, it can go way back to, back to the 17th and 18th 1800s when we really didn't know a lot about how this whole environmentally friendly landscaping works.
I mean, Europeans just brought the plants that they liked with them?
Brought the plants that they were familiar with from Europe. Like lawns, for instance. Lawns came out of Eastern Europe, and they're not really that environmentally friendly, okay? You look what they did in Central Park. I mean, if they knew today what they knew back then, they would have never planted Norway maples or a lot of the European species that exist. I mean, you look at Prospect Park. Prospect Park has a lot more native plants going on because it's a much more natural type park. So It's all based on observation and education. And over the past two centuries, we've learned that native plants are so important to our natural environment.
We have put London plane trees up along our sidewalks because they withstand all sorts of pests and such. But they're not native either. And do they have a negative impact?
Well, I don't know how much of a negative impact. I don't think they have what might be a negative impact, but they don't have as much of a positive impact as, let's say, a sycamore tree does, okay, where there's more insects and animals eating that type of, whether it's the bark, whether it's the leaves, whether it's the seed. Even ginkgos, when it comes to city and street trees, ginkgos are type of tree that they thought was extinct. Here's a tree that was native to the 45th parallel right around the planet, and then they thought it was extinct, okay? And then they found it growing in these isolated mountain valleys of China, and they brought them out, and they started planting them, and they have a very high tolerance to pollution. And that's why you see ginkgos going around, being planted around. But oak trees, I think when it comes to street trees, and I know New York City has rules and regulations on the type of street trees can be used, I strongly recommend using natives or exotics for a lot of reasons.
You say that we can make gardening easier and more productive by cutting weeds rather than pulling them. The inclination is to pull the weeds, kill them.
That's right. And, when you pull weeds, what you do is you expose the soil that's underneath the weed. And when you expose that soil, what happens is that there's a lot of dormant seeds underneath there that can germinate once the soil is exposed. By cutting the weed, okay, you're not disturbing the soil. You're keeping those microbes moving around and working the soil. And over time, you just keep cutting the weed and cutting the weed and cutting the weed. And it can't conduct photosynthesis, so it dies. And then some of the more aggressive natives will take the place of it. And not only that, Leonard, but it's easier. Think about it. Going down on your hands and knees and ripping and tearing at a weed and then, putting it in a wheelbarrow or a bucket and getting rid of it. By cutting it, you can do a lot of gardening a lot faster, and it's a more environmentally friendly approach.
Isn't it easier to cut plants before the old growth gets tangled in with the new growth?
Yes, it is. And this is a great time of year to start doing some pruning in your landscape. You can see the bone structure of a shrub or tree. You can get right into it. Are there any vines growing into it? And just get in there and open it up and let the air get into it. Because you got to remember, too, funguses were going crazy last summer because of all the heavy rain we have. Powdery mildew, apple cedar rust. It was all over the place. But by pruning now and opening up the canopy or the branching structure of a tree, lets the air come into the tree or shrub, and it'll do much better, and the funguses can't fester in a very tight environment. Also, when it comes to planting trees, let's say you have a hole in your landscape that's 3 or 4 feet tall and about 2 or 3 feet wide. What you want to do is you want to bring in a plant that grows to that height and width. So you're not like a beech plum or something that's going to, or a type of viburnum or a New Jersey tea or something that's going to grow to that height and width so that it's not going to grow 10 or 15 feet tall and you're going to be out there all summer pruning the thing.
So how long does it take to grow to a height that you like?
It all depends on the size of the shrub that you buy, mm-hmm. and how much the type of growing season you have. Like last year, things put on two or three times the amount of growth that they usually do because we had such a rainy summer.
This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. We are taking your calls for Pete Murawski at 212-209-2877. And let's take one of those calls. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Oh, that's great. Listen, I started with a avocado seed, and I, you know, said, let me see if I could grow it. Well, it's in my house now, and it's up to the ceiling, so it's 8 feet tall. I've got it in a big container. My question is this. How large does an avocado tree grow? And if I put it out in New York, I assume it will die. So where am I with this tree in my house? That's number one. The second question is, I have a hibiscus plant, and I understood they bloom beautifully, but they don't last too long, and I've had this for 5 years. But I said, let me help the soil, so I put some worms in both of the pots. Question, do worms add or do they take away? Do they eat at the roots? Because the hibiscus, the leaves turned brown and started falling off. But I see now I have new leaves coming in. But my question focuses on the worms. Do worms add to a plant? Do they help or do they
Do they aerate the soil?
That's what they do. The worms are going to aerate the soil, which is going to help the roots of the hibiscus grow. It's really not giving it any kind of nutrient value, though, because what the worms do, and they're not eating the roots, they're eating the soil, and they're pooping out, so to speak, a lot of whatever they're getting out of the soil. So what you want might
want... And that doesn't enrich the soil?
It does, but not a lot, especially when you're talking about a containerized plant. Mm-hmm. Container plants, you know, when you think about plants that grow in the wild, the roots are able to get out there, you know, 20, 30 feet and find what they need from the soil and bring it back. When plants are in containers, they're basically depending on you for survival. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to give them a little bit more nutrients than they're getting just from... the worms. Do you do any fertilizing of the hibiscus?
Well, I give all my plants plant food, grow.
Miracle-Gro.
I feed them, you know, plant food.
Right.
Well, and the leaves that fall off, I put them back in, you know, in the pot. I cut the leaves up fine, and I put the leaves back in the pot.
Now, when the leaves fall off, are they turning black and yellow and just kind of falling off the plant? Or are they just...
They're like yellowish brown. I have another, I don't know what it is, but I've had that over 10, I guess maybe 15 years. I have this other plant that they call it elephant leaves or something
right.
like that.
Well, you might want to
huge plant.
Right, you might want to cut back the watering on the hibiscus a little bit. It sounds like you may be overwatering the plant.
Oh, okay.
And that's why you're getting the yellowing and blacking of the leaves. So cut way back on the watering of the plant.
And what about the avocado?
Now, the avocado, it sounds like you're having a great time with that. You know, that'll get very big in the house. And don't be afraid, especially this time of year, to prune it right back. But I think what's going to benefit the avocado is if once you prune it back to a manageable size, because it sounds like it's getting too big for the container, see if you can't slide it out onto a patio somewhere after.
Oh, I do. I put it out in the summertime.
Oh, good.
Now, can I cut the top of the tree?
Yes.
Because it's growing. It's up to the ceiling.
Yeah,
it's
no.
pushing against the ceiling.
Don't be afraid to aggressively cut something like this either. You know, you can you can cut stuff, especially this time of year. You got to remember, plants do sense that it's springtime. because if you got it by a window, they know this. They're getting more light, and they're telling that it's time to reproduce. So it's going to start producing flowers, and it's going to want to create some fruit. So if you put it outside after the last frost, but like you said, don't be afraid to aggressively prune this this avocado right now before you bring it outside, and it'll leaf right up just fine.
Okay, thank you so much for your call. Let's take another call. Hi, BAI, you're on the air.
It'll leaf right up just fine.
You're hearing us on delay, so turn off your radio and just listen in the phone, okay?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes, I garden a lot, and I have a little advice. Maybe if you have little plants or seedlings, try different things. If you took, you have 30 seeds in a pack, maybe take three of those and try different things kind of near each other and see what works and what doesn't work just to learn. But I have a question. A lot of plants are planted outside in the ground, then there are container plants. Sometimes it just rains like crazy, and they're getting way too much water. I even thought of putting a cover over some plants, and sometimes I put plants in a container, and I can bring them onto the porch and keep them out of the rain. Of course, they need water, but too much water. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, what you could do is, like you said, you could take them out of the water. You could put plastic bags over the top of the containers so that a lot of water doesn't get into the container itself. But if you're putting them in the ground, and if you've got heavy soils, put them in a raised bed situation where plant them a little bit higher than lower so that they get a little bit more drainage, and that's going to help during these
periods. Also, I'm on Long Island, and what I do sometimes is add some sand and pebbles, and that helps drainage, and it actually has good nutrition for the plants, too.
That's a good idea. But like you said, in the last couple of years, we've had periods of heavy rain, and I mean, if you look at the forecast now, we're going to get a lot of rain tonight and tomorrow. They're talking about an inch or two of cold rain, and if you got anything outside, some of this stuff could rot in this heavy rain. So keep an eye to the sky and adjust your gardening techniques as the weather changes.
And Pete, there's the possibility of some frosts still coming because the weather has been so erratic.
Well, Leonard, it's still only the end of February, and everybody wants spring to come right away. I mean, you look at this forecast.
A farmer once told me you don't even bother thinking about it until May 15th.
May 15th, and up by us, May 30th. If you look at the forecast for the next couple days, we've got an inch and a half of rain, but parts of the Catskills, the Berkshires, and the Adirondacks, they're talking about winter storm warnings, and these people could still see a foot and a half of heavy, wet snow. So be thankful we're not going to get any of that.
Are your questions answered, caller?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for your call. Let's take another call. BAI, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Pete. So I live next door to a vacant lot, and there were three cats. And the cats jump in the yard all the time, and now that it's spring and I want to get out there and plant some things, I'm so worried that they're going to do their business in my yard, which they have been doing all winter anyways. So do you have any suggestions for some natural products or something that I could use to deter them from coming in the yard? And I would have to put it all over the yard and of course, be sure that it doesn't harm the plants.
Well, is it bad that the plant, that the cats are urinating or defecating in the yard? Isn't that a natural fertilizer?
Yes and no, and it all depends on how much they're defecating. Do you have, because Leonard and I just had this conversation before we started, do you have a dog?
No.
Because a lot of times they'll chase the cats away. I've heard people using mothball flakes around the perimeter of your property. Sometimes that helps. They don't like the smell of mothballs. But cat problems can be, because the urea, the urine is very acidic. And you could just get things planted in there, and the next thing you know, they're ripping and tearing at stuff. That's really an issue, and that I'm not too familiar with, but you might want to look online to see what, you know, some people are saying about that, and maybe somebody has come up with something that'll work for you. But
you say mothballs might be a deterrent?
Might be a deterrent, or mothball flakes around the perimeter of her yard. She can try that.
Do I have to put that down every after it rains?
No, the mothballs will last almost a growing season. They last quite long, and don't be afraid to put them down fairly heavy.
And it won't disturb the plants at all.
Not if you keep them away from the plants, like I said, around the perimeter of your yard.
Not
amongst the plants, but before the cats enter the yard, in and around the perimeter.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, I'll try that. Thanks so much.
And thank you for your call. And a reminder, our number here is 212-209-2877. If you have a gardening question for Pete Murawski, should we be planting tomatoes and pepper seeds and some other things indoors first before we take them out?
Yeah, you know, it's a good idea, Leonard, to get a head start on a lot of stuff. And now's the time to do that. Peppers, lettuce, tomatoes. You can start just about anything inside and then bring it out just as the weather starts getting better.
So lettuce, kale, broccoli?
All of the above. You know, especially broccoli. Eggplant is something that needs a long growing season. So if you like eggplant and you want to plant eggplant, I would strongly recommend putting eggplant seeds in early in the season or indoors and, before you bring them outside.
And that means now?
Right now or 2 weeks ago.
Let's take another call. Our number here again, 212-209-2877. Hi, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good for me. I have a very high clay content soil in southern Staten Island. It's almost like a brick. And we have some pretty large oak trees in the backyard. But what happens is because the water doesn't go into the ground, there's a few low spots, and it's exposing the roots of the trees. Can I fill in those low spots over the roots, or will that be a problem?
No, you can fill them in, and fill them in with soil that's very sandy, that has some organic content in it, that has a little body to it, so it helps the soil drain a little bit. Clay is tough. Clay is one of the toughest types of soils to deal with because of its moisture holding capacity and that it doesn't drain very well. So anything that you can put into the soil that's going to help with drainage, sand, compost, and mixing in with that clay soil, you're going to find that not only are the trees going to be happy you did that, but it's also going to help with the soil structure.
You suggest,
so I can raise the grade and cover the roots, and the water will go away from the trees.
Yes, just be careful how high you raise the grade. How big are these trees? What's the diameter of the trunk?
They're at least 30 inches, 40 inches, big, tall, beautiful.
Yeah, put the soil in between the large roots that are heading down into the ground, and kind of level the area from root to root with the good soil, if you follow what I'm saying.
You suggest planting densely.
That's right. What I mean by densely is that if, let's say, you're going to put a garden in of shrubs and perennials, you know, don't just put a shrub and a perennial here and a shrub there and a perennial here and create these little sparse-looking gardens with oceans of mulch. Plant densely. Plant shrubs and trees very close together that have different types of soil, a different type of leaf structures, and then let them grow together. So that, and that is another way to hide a lot of the weeds that may grow in your garden, by planting a landscape densely. And if you do it that way, each fall when the leaves fall to the ground, that'll be your natural mulch. And after 3 or 4 years, you'll be saving your money on mulch in your garden, because you won't have to put so much mulch out there, because these trees and shrubs will take care of themselves using Mother Nature as your guide.
Does that apply to your situation, caller? Oh, he's gone. Okay. Well, my guest on today's Leonard Lopate at Large is Pete Murawski of Native Landscapes and Garden Center in Pawling, New York. Talk to Pete Murawski about gardening and related matters, and let's get to as many of them as we can. Hi, BAI, you're on the air.
Hi. Are you, I don't know if you're talking to me. Hello?
Yes, you.
Oh, okay. I have a tremendous amount of deer. I mean, we get sometimes 8 or more deer in the morning, and last year they ate all the flowers in one day that came up. So I put fencing, but they're very strong, so they get over the fencing sometime, and they eat more of the plants that we have. The shrubs, little shrubs are all gone. They ate all those. And then we have rodents, you know, like the little field mice. So these little critters also go under the garden area that we have fenced in, and they eat any potatoes or onions or anything that is underneath the ground, as well as on top of the ground, like raspberries. So can I evict these guys? And then there's ticks. I have grandchildren who play outdoors, and I'm concerned about the ticks.
Now, Pete, you have a whole list of deer-resistant plants, but none of the ones that the caller mentioned are on that list?
Like Leonard said, I'm staring at a list of a lot of different type of deer-resistant plants. What shrubs and trees did you say you have growing on the property that they're going after?
Well, all the ones you mentioned earlier, which are probably not native, hyacinth, tulips, daisies, and, you know, a lot of stuff like that. They just have lunch on those or breakfast.
Right.
And then we have ash trees, which are very beautiful, and they sometimes eat the bark. It's like, you know.
You know, you're in one of those areas maybe that the only thing they don't eat is plastic and metal.
Leave that for the whales.
You may have to go. I mean, how much property do you own?
We have 2 acres.
Okay. Did you ever consider, I mean, if you're that much of a gardener, and we take care of, big land properties like you have up in the Hudson Valley, I try to convince customers to put a fence around their property. Because if you're really into gardening and you want to grow anything that's available in your zone, you can always we put up a game fence, and it's got to be 6 to 8 feet tall, depending on your topography. And the game fence has little rectangular holes on the bottom and then, much bigger holes on the top. So what you're doing is you're keeping the critters out of the bottom and you're keeping the deer from jumping over. And the only thing that these fences don't keep out are bear, because bear will cry right over them.
Yeah.
But anyway, if you go to nativelandscaping.net and or call the garden center, we'll send you a list of deer-resistant plants so that when it's time to make some changes to your landscape, you can go with wonderful things like little blue stem, the red columbine, the bleeding hearts, the cone flowers, the snake root. I mean, the list is endless. Coral bells. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there that are fairly deer-resistant, and I think that's the direction you need to go when it comes to putting new stuff in your garden, and try to use these type of plants, and maybe you can deter the deer from coming in. But like I said, there are some areas, like over in Sherman, Connecticut, and just some areas that I find that are just, it's literally, I've seen them eating boxwood and Andromeda over there.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just sometimes it's very tough, and you maybe need to net or fence some of these areas in, but start first with deer-resistant plants, and we can get you a list sooner than later.
Okay.
Well, ticks. Hello? Ticks.
Yeah, what about
yes.
the ticks?
The
ticks, they love barberry.
Yes.
Do we pull out the barberry, or do we cut the barberry?
I would cut it at ground level, and in some cases pull it up. There's a lot of, with these invasive plants, do you have barberry on your property or on the perimeter of your property? Do you grow any barberry on your property?
Oh, I meant ticks that are bugs.
Yes, but I'm saying, we're talking about
plants. No, I don't have barberry.
Barberry is is all over the place, and the ticks wind up in the barberry, and then animals walk by the barberry. The ticks go on to the deer or your dog or whatever. And or you, So that's that's why barberry, and there are some other plants that also attract ticks, but
right.
but barberry seem to be the worst villains.
Okay.
Yeah, what you want to do is you want to keep your property fairly clean of landscape debris. That's where the ticks tend to hang. And, you know, attract birds to your property. You know,
once again,
when native plants bring in birds, you know, bluebirds, any of these birds that eat bugs, if you can bring in plants or shrubs that attract birds, the birds will eat the ticks and you'll be part of this whole ecosystem and they'll keep the ticks down. But until you get to the point where there aren't as many ticks on the property, just double check yourself every time you come into the house. I mean, you know, you can have fun checking each other for ticks. And,
great. Thank you. You guys are good.
You.
All right.
Now, before we go to another call, I know a lot of our listeners are apartment dwellers. Does spring really matter if you're an apartment dweller? Isn't an apartment... spring 12 months a year in a way?
You mean the inside of the apartment?
Yes.
Yes, for the most part. And it all depends on what direction your apartment faces. If your apartment faces south, boy, you can grow anything. If your apartment faces north, then you have a lot of shade. But think about the apartments too, Leonard. I mean, if you got an apartment that has quite a big a deck around it or on the outside of it, and you want to bring some of your shrubs or indoor plants inside to outside, I mean, you go up 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 floors, and you get into another climate zone up there. I mean, I've been to situations where, and we've done some terrace gardens, where you get up on the top of a skyscraper and it's snowing up there, and then it's raining at the bottom of the building. So, you know, there's a lot going on outside a building, depending on what your floor is and you know, what direction your apartment is facing.
Just one more thing before we take another call. Just heard a news report that there was a unanimous jury decision in San Francisco federal court yesterday against Roundup being linked to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. What are your thoughts about pesticides like Roundup?
Well, what my thoughts are is if you create a landscape with plants that have the same cultural requirements, you don't need to do a lot of pesticide applications. And what I mean by that is, let's say behind your house you have a swamp area or you have wet soils. You know, don't bring in plants like yucca and potentilla that like dry locations. Bring in plants like winterberry holly and swamp azaleas and stuff that likes that particular environment. Because when you bring in plants that are stressed because you're bringing in a plant that doesn't thrive in that environment, that's when bugs come in and that's when you got to spray a lot of pesticides. I think if the right landscape is created, very little pesticide use is necessary. Now, Roundup is an interesting story because Roundup has been used for many, many years. And I think one of the biggest problems that started to happen with Roundup is when they started making Roundup resistant corn and vegetables. And that's when we started to get some problems.
Now, GMOs. What were they called?
GMOs.
GMOs.
Now, think about, you know, when you got a Roundup ready field of corn and that corn is cut down and then the water runoff is going into the hedgerow next to it. That's why a lot of these milkweed are getting killed, and that's why you have a big problem or a lack of monarch butterflies now, because a lot of these chemicals are being, you know, flushed into a lot of these natural areas that really can't tolerate these chemicals. I think chemistry from a herbicide and pesticide standpoint really needs to be looked at very hard and needs to be changed sooner than later, because a lot of this stuff is toxic, and we need to go with more of a environmentally friendly you know, like you were saying, Roundup is a herbicide. You know, there's a lot of horticultural vinegars that could take its place. A lot of different types of soap. You can make a herbicide. You know, I've seen people using flame torches to take care of plants in
their
walkway.
You could just take kitchen soap and spray your plants with that?
With vinegar.
With vinegar. With
vinegar. It's got to be very acidic, and that'll kill the plants too. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff online right now, but I think from a chemistry standpoint, and I'm hoping that a lot of these chemical companies are researching this, that, you know, the chemistry needs to be changed to create a more environmentally friendly spray group out there.
Let's take another call. BAI, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Oh, great, great. I have inside, I have rubber plants. I have outside on my terrace pine trees and various other trees. Now, do rubber plant leaves and pine needles, does that make mulch? Is it decent for mulch for everything or just certain plants?
Well, no, you bring up an interesting concept because you think about what happens in Mother Nature, you know. Like, for instance, take a white pine, for instance. When the white pine in the fall, it sheds its needles. Those needles get right underneath the tree and they break down. They become a natural fertilizer for that tree. So if you got a rubber plant in the house and any of the leaves die, mince or chop those leaves right up and put it, as long as there's no disease in it, put it right back in the container, because that's the type of mulch the plant wants. It doesn't want a foreign mulch. It wants a mulch that it's accustomed to, that they would find growing in the wild. And even the pine that you're growing out on the porch, when that pine, it's called needle cast. When it starts casting those needles off of the tree, scoop those needles up and put it right into the container. And as those needles decompose, not only will they feed the plant, but they'll also keep the weeds down.
What about kitchen scraps? Mixing it with them or keeping them separate?
Kitchen scraps need to be composted first. You just can't put them in raw. You got to put kitchen scraps into a...
And no meat, of course.
Right. they got to be put into a compost, and they got to be composted first before you can put them raw into your plants.
They break down and they become, if you compost them long enough, they almost look like soil.
That's right. That's exactly right. And in a situation like that, you're in an apartment like that, I don't know how much of a deck you got, but you probably don't have enough of an area to create a composted area that you might want to go somewhere and
get
buy
a small compost can.
You can. You can get a small compost.
I usually take the kitchen scraps and throw them in a big pot, leave it there for a year or two, mixing with soil, and that seems to do nicely for my... I have a terrace that's it's 35 feet long but 5.5 feet deep. It's just a long terrace. And the whole terrace is lined with volunteer trees that I've picked up through the years, including oak, quaking elm, pine, maple, blueberry, bush, etc. And they're all doing pretty fine. I lost a lot of oaks last year.
But don't be afraid, because you got such a small area, to prune a lot of those trees aggressively back. Prune them hard. And this is the time of year to do that, just before bud break. You know, prune them in the wintertime when you can see that branching structure, when you can see the skeleton of a tree. Prune them right back so that...
Yeah, because I'm walking sideways now.
Right. Well, get out there with your pruners and so you can continue to walk shoulder to shoulder.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot for the advice.
And thank you for your call. Let's take another call. BAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Christina. I'm a street gardener, and I like to plant around trees. And some trees on my block, I just started planting around four trees on my block. They have brick walls around them, and the soil has been filled in around the trunk. And I heard that that's really bad for the tree. So I started by removing a small bag, like as much as I could carry bag from each plot, to reduce the soil level gradually. And I wanted to know, is that the right thing? And also, is there a best kind of flower to plant under a small to medium-sized tree?
Well, Christina, you're doing the right thing, okay, because there is an air transfer that goes on between surface roots of the tree and the soil. And a lot of trees will choke to death if they don't have that air transfer in and around the roots of that tree. And not only that, but the bark, the surface roots, and the trunk can rot if it's sitting under soil like that. So, yes, removing that soil, if it's getting up on a tree 3, 4, 5, 6 inches, is the right thing to do. Now, you also wanted to – is there something we you can – what was the next question?
Well, I wanted to know what the best thing to plant is. Someone gave me anemone bulbs, which I planted about 3 weeks ago, and I don't know much about them, but I was told they last about 6 weeks. So they'll be gone by probably the late spring. And what's a good thing to plant underneath the tree, given that the soil is still built up and it's the trees are still small? They're not casting a lot of shade, and I wanted something colorful.
But, Pete, somebody once said to me, with fronds like these, who needs anemones?
See that? But anyway, there are a lot of different types of flower. You know, I would go with something a little bit more of a perennial. Are you familiar with moss phlox? Okay, moss phlox is a ground cover that flowers in about a month, and it's a native, and it creeps along, and it comes in some beautiful colors. It comes in pink, it comes in white, it comes in light lavender. And you could poke these in around the trunks of the trees, and you talk about a beautiful cascading, flowing type of flower around the trunk of the tree. That's what I would strongly recommend. And here's something that comes back every year. I mean, you don't have to plant an annual every year. This is something that will come back every year in the springtime, and it's called moss phlox. Subulata, phlox subulata. And when you plant it, it's absolutely beautiful.
Okay.
I have seen that. Well, one more question. See, since it's a problem because since I'm reducing the soil every time I plant a perennial, I would have to dig them up every time. So I've been planting annuals partly because I thought, well, it's good for the tree to kind of, you know, aerate, you know, turn over the soil. And also when I planted these trees that were filled up, I found all these feeder roots. I guess the tree to survive that it, you know, had shot roots up from the ground, you know, close to the surface.
Whatever works for you, if whatever you like to look at, that's what should be planted there.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Thank you so much for your call. And we have two more calls. I don't know if we're going to be able to get them both in, but we will try. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question. I've got a question, but a previous caller talked about cats, how to deter them from her garden. First thing you have to do is you should never use mothballs. They're toxic to cats and humans. Then you have to clean the area where the cat has left the scent, because they'll always come back to that. You have to, you know, really clean it well. And then you can interplant a lot of herbs, which will deter the cat from coming back, like lemon thyme, rue, pennyroyal, all these things. And also they like to walk on very soft soil, so you have to put like twigs and pine cones in that area, and that really helps. And you can also use like sprays, like you can put like pepper in a spray. They don't like any sharp scents, like they don't like a mustard or cinnamon, and you can put that in a little bottle, and they don't like clove, and you can spray that, like garlic clove, and spray that in the area also.
Great. Thank you very much.
And we will take your advice. We've got one more call. Hi, you're on the air.
I'm on the air?
Yes.
Good afternoon. This is Millie from Brooklyn. I bought a fig leaf plant last summer, and around September, I started getting browning around the edges of the leaves, but I also got these circular lines, you know, like little brown circles on the leaves. And by the winter, I was losing a lot of leaves. There were a lot of leaves growing on top, But when I bought the plant, it was very bushy and full and vital, but I lost all those bottom leaves. Do you have any tips for me about the brown spotting?
Right.
And brown?
Once again, you know, and it seems to be a common problem out there, is we're watering too much. You know, let the plant completely dry out before you water again. A lot of people think that, you know, once the surface gets a little bit dry, that it needs to be watered again. But put your finger in the soil a good 2 or 3 inches and find out how wet it really is down there, because it sounds like you're watering a little too much.
Okay, and I'm letting the leaves that fall, I let them stay on top of the pot. Would that hold the moisture in?
Well, yes, but it's also because you have a it might. But if it's a fungus, without seeing it, I don't know. It may also be a fungus, and if you're leaving the leaves on top of the plant, it may be creating more fungus spores. So, you know, be careful.
That's what I thought, that circular brown, because it was like a pattern.
Yeah.
On the leaves, and some of it will leave a little hole in the leaf. What can you do if it's a fungus? Because I've been suspicious of that.
Yeah, you got to dry it out. You know, you could... Because fungicides are a little bit tough. Sometimes if a plant gets really infected or infested, you may have to replace it with something,
mm-hmm.
with a new one. But, mm-hmm. You know, you might want to take it down to your local nursery or florist and get their, you know, take pictures of it and show it to them, somebody who's really knowledgeable about stuff like that. And once they see the picture of it, they'll direct you on where to go with it.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you for your call. For people who are gardening outside, right now the soil is still kind of chilly and damp. Is it too chilly and damp for many vegetables? What are the hardiest varieties? What should we be thinking about right now before it warms up?
Well, a lot of the lettuces and radishes can take the cold weather. But you bring up a good point, Leonard, and that is the soil too wet? Because if you're planting in a wet soil compaction can be a big problem. And, you know, like with that, we were talking with that lady, that there's a lot of air transfer that goes on between the plant roots and the soil. If you plant in a situation where the soil is too wet, the soil compaction will literally choke a plant out. Mm. Now, the cold, the temperature of the soil, as long as it's not frozen, doesn't usually bother some of these cold, hardy vegetables. You know, like right now, we still got 1.5 to 2 inches of frost in our ground, you know, north of, let's say, White Plains. But, you know, Long Island, Southern Jersey, and parts of Pennsylvania, your soil is ready to go from a standpoint of planting cold, hardy vegetables. But be careful, excuse me, once again, with soil moisture. And as we were saying before, we're going to get a lot of rain tonight and tomorrow. And which is going to supersaturate the soil again. So
there may be snow coming next week.
And there may be snow next week. So, you know, keep an eye to the sky, keep your finger in the soil, and you should be able to guide yourself into the right direction.
Any other tips before we go?
Yeah, you know, there seems to be a trend toward edible landscapes in the last couple of years. You know, we're getting a lot of calls with people who want to put more fruit and vegetables into fruit flowering shrubs into their garden. And the recommendations and suggestions I'm making is, rather than doing vinca or pachysandra in a garden, use strawberries as a ground cover. You know, plant blueberries, plant plums, you know, elderberries. There's a lot of neat shrubs and trees out there that you can plant in your garden. And not only do they flower and look nice, but they'll also give you a fruit. And these fruits are so good for you.
And you don't get any fruit from pachysandra. The only reason that people put it in is because it's hardy?
And it's an evergreen and it looks good, you know. But it's really not doing anything for the environment or us. Well, when you say pachysandra. Okay, let's define that a little bit. There's Oriental spurge, which is the Japanese Pachycandra, but there's also an Allegheny spurge, which is the native Pachycandra. So I strongly recommend the native Pachycandra, but not the Oriental Pachycandra.
Pete Moreski is the owner of Native Landscapes and Garden Center in Pawling, New York, on Route 22. Thank you so much for being on our show. We'll see you in a couple of months.
Thank you, Leonard.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to everyone who called in, to Pete Moreski, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Let It Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Let It Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Let It Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.